Secretary General of Amnesty International talks about Google and Facebook's insidious control of our digital lives undermines the very essence of our privacy, is one of the defining human rights challenges of our era, and also that it's just this, it can, these platforms, Facebook in particular, can be these massive platforms of fraudulent behavior and fraudulent identity. And I have to ask you, how do you, are you ever to be an activist on this platform, even fighting against the platform, or fighting for better socialized, just platforms, things like that? I mean, do you feel dirty being on the, being on the deck of the mediums that are, that are causing all that, all this harm?
Yes and no. I mean, part of it is that the platforms are reflective of reality, right? You know, there wouldn't be propaganda without propagandists. There wouldn't be these troll farms without people who are willing to run them and work for them, which is why in my activities, I try to be overt about it. Although I have talked about, like, if there's an uneven enough playing field where actors on the right are able to lie with impunity and the platforms are saying that's how our platforms work, how do you combat that? I think that that's the biggest moral conundrum that I'm faced with presently. I ran through my gubernatorial campaign, I ran an ad for a week that implied that, or it said and reacted to news that Sean Hannity had replaced VP Pence on the 2020 ticket, and that evangelicals were upset about that. And while it's interesting, someone commented and they said, it's great that everyone here recognizes that this is fake, but they don't recognize the bigger point it's making, you know, that this fake news is perfectly allowed by Facebook. And someone reacted to that, you know, without getting the premise either, you know, saying it doesn't matter what happens, Trump is going to win. You know, it's like, you know, people have the thing where they say, let's quit Facebook or let's quit Twitter. It's usually let's quit Facebook, because Facebook is just, is pretty gross all around. And yet I quit Facebook a decade ago. I think that was the first time I quit. I've quit it at least twice, maybe three times, just deleted my account. You know, Amnesty International on the 21st of November came out with a 60-page report on these platforms, particularly Google and Facebook. And they're now global human rights violators, global human rights threats. It's not something that you can solve by staying off it. You can only solve it by regulating. Now, I think that the elegance of some of the work that I've been doing and that the Really Online Lefty League pack has been doing is exposing the hypocrisy of the platforms, just ridiculing them, showing how weak and inconsistent their policies are. And the big challenge is, will state, federal, or, you know, regulators in other countries outside of the US step up and whip these platforms into shape? Because right now it's just like, you know, everyone criticizing or reacting to the platform's plans. And it's like, no, we, you know, many of the countries where these platforms operate are democracies, and it's time to wake up and do something. I mean, the Amnesty report really focused on the surveillance business model. And their concern is that there are many governments that want the data that these companies are collecting, and whether that's to attack the U.S., whether that's to impose, you know, surveillance on their own citizens, they're collecting this data. They have this data, and the governments of the world are kind of have been really standing aside. And it was the crazy thing was, in my case, when Facebook said that they would treat me differently than other politicians after I filed for office, the reaction to that, the UK Parliament had a reaction, but nothing from anyone in the US government. It's almost like these companies have become de facto governments of their own. I know, you know, it's called Facebookistan. Micah Sifry of Civic Hall in New York reached out and asked me to write something about it. And, you know, he said that many in the civic tech community have been concerned for a long time, like I was when I quit Facebook a decade ago. that these platforms are having a really negative influence on society. And, you know, we can hope that the regulators will take it seriously. And I know that Elizabeth Warren and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have both, you know, taken an interest in this. Warren to break up Facebook, and AOC, it looks more like investigation and regulation.
What about nationalization?
I mean, I think that it's interesting. So to read another piece out of the Amnesty report, and this is one of their conclusions in the exec summary of their report. And it says, ultimately, it's now evident that the era of self-regulation in the tech sector is coming to an end. Further state-based regulation will be necessary, but it's vital that whatever form future regulation of the technology sector takes, governments follow a human rights-based approach. So I think one of the things that nationalization brings up, I like it in concept. The challenges, for example, if you have a Trump government,
no, precisely,
and then all of a sudden they're running, you know, they're running this the greatest surveillance platforms ever conceived. Yeah, then you're very much in like a 1984 situation, right? And we already see the platforms catering to the administration through allowing sites like Daily Caller and Daily Wire to have special privileges and to be exempt from rules that would capture others. And I think with Facebook's policy around truth in political advertising and exempting politicians from fact-checking, that's also a policy meant to favor Trump and his re-election campaign. So how do you regulate the platforms in a way that follows a human rights-based approach? I'm very much... you know, I think that Elizabeth Warren wanting to break them up is good. You know, you can't have all of these, you know, Instagram, WhatsApp, Facebook, all collecting data about you. You know, you can't switch from one to the other without still being tracked for ad targeting purposes. The idea that I was thinking about, and I really want to start hearing from different folks about how they would regulate or nationalize or break up, there were two concepts that I think are really relevant to this debate. One is the idea of independent oversight. And one area this you can see this is like police oversight bodies, like police commissions that are made up of citizens. In San Francisco, city government even has like a separate investigatory body to investigate complaints against the police, and it's totally separate. And it's got civilian oversight. So you could see some kind of, I guess the other example is important too, because that's the newspaper industry or media industry, where there traditionally has been this position called the ombudsman. And this is a person who is kind of independent from editorial decisions and from the newsroom and from also independent from the advertising side and maybe even from most of the executives at a newspaper. And they're an independent person who's able to respond to complaints about the media or that particular outlet. So if you're the ombudsman for the New York Times and so he says, well, you know, you ran this thing that said that, you know, the Iraq war was predicated on Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction, the ombudsman person, they can go back and say, well, you know, here's the facts, here's what the reporter wrote, and kind of give it a second look in the public interest and in the public eye. So imagine for something like Facebook, where I run a fake ad and people flag it. Right now, it's just this black box. So there's a concept in technology called open source. And it was very popular 10 years ago, and it continues to be popular, but it's propagated a lot by for-profit companies that deploy open source technologies. But open source is basically you can see the code. So with Facebook, you can't tell what's going on. When someone makes a complaint about abuse on the platform, someone makes a complaint, disinformation, and or if you make an appeal about an action that they took, it's very, very opaque. You don't have the names of the people at Facebook who are, you know, they send you messages that are signed just by Facebook. A lot of the processes are automated. And to scale a tool like Facebook, a lot of the processes do have to be automated. But you can imagine that instead of having third-party fact checkers and contracted moderators and these opaque processes. One, you could open source it so you know why things are happening on the platform the way they're happening. What are the automated actions and what are the branches and trees of how decisions are made? And then you could also have this public body that actually, instead of having rules and standards that are internal to Facebook, like they have a lot of smart, very well paid people working on policy there. And I know they have handbooks about how to moderate, how to handle different events. What if that was all transparent, so that you could interact with it? You would know what you're up against when you're an advertiser, and you should know the playing field. And it should be a fair playing field for all. And then imagine that the complaints go to these independent entity that's probably financed by Facebook, but regulated and staffed by a government entity, for example. And then they're the ones making the rulings on whether something should stay up or come down. And those are public, they're transparent. And that would be a radical departure. It would still basically work the same way, but if you had open source and true independence and citizen oversight, things would be very different. Right now, Facebook is talking about having its own like oversights body that is like an ombudspeople, but it's still run by Facebook, and I think it needs to be run by the state and in a transparent way. But it's challenging when if you don't like what your state is doing, then that power could still be a threat. I mean, a lot of what Amnesty is talking about is the threat of states being able to use this data. And they say that if, you, Matt, me, Adriel, we would not let the state knowingly collect this much data about ourselves, our browser habits, our, et cetera, et cetera. And yet these companies are doing it because they're providing entertainment, they're providing, a place to work and converse and organize, and yet they're collecting all this data about us at the same time that could be used in a hostile way.
Sacha Baron Cohen denounced Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Google as the greatest propaganda machine in history and culpable for a surge in murderous attacks on religious and ethnic minorities. The actor focused on Facebook, saying that if you pay them, the platform will run any political ad you want, even if it's a lie. Which that's familiar language. He was speaking in New York on Thursday at Never Is Now, the Anti-Defamation League's Summit on Anti-Semitism and Hate, where he was presented with the organization's International Leadership Award. And we have a clip.
Incredibly powerful speech. It's like 26 minutes long in full. The Really Online Lefty League, which is a PAC that the Adriel Hampton Group works with. It's a PAC that I founded. We did a 2-minute ad based on that speech, and it really boils it down to its essence. So maybe we can play that for our listeners.
Democracy, which depends on shared truths, is in retreat, and autocracy, which depends on shared lies, is on the march. All this hate and violence is being facilitated by a handful of internet companies that amount to the greatest propaganda machine in history. This is ideological imperialism. 6 unelected individuals in Silicon Valley imposing their vision on the rest of the world, unaccountable to any government and acting like they're above the reach of law. Zuckerberg at Facebook, Sundar Pichai at Google, at its parent company, Alphabet, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, Brin's ex-sister-in-law, Susan Wojcicki at YouTube, and Jack Dorsey at Twitter. The Silicon Six. All billionaires who care more about boosting their share price than about protecting democracy. One of the heads of Google, in fact, told me that these sites just show both sides of the issue.
Very fine people on both sides.
If Facebook were around in the 1930s, it would have allowed Hitler to post 30-second ads on his solution to the Jewish problem.
Our policy is that we do not fact-check politicians.
These are the richest companies in the world. They could fix these problems if they wanted to. Instead of letting the Silicon Six decide the fate of the world, Let our elected representatives, voted for by the people of every democracy in the world, have at least some say. By now, it's pretty clear they cannot be trusted to regulate themselves. As with the Industrial Revolution, it's time for regulation and legislation to curb the greed of these high-tech robber barons.
So it's significant that Sacha Baron Cohen expands this beyond Facebook, just like Amnesty. You have Amnesty, and I don't know if it's a coincidence or not that these were both on the same day. The Amnesty report dropped. Sacha Baron Cohen did this speech. And one of the points that they both make, he calls it the greatest propaganda machines in history, and Amnesty calls Facebook and Google some of the greatest threats to human rights of our time.
Because of
and
surveillance. Right. So it's this sort of terrifying marriage of surveillance and propaganda.
Yes. And Sacha Baron Cohen is, he had a line, you know, we heard about Zuckerberg would have sold ads to Hitler in the 1930s. And that's just a shocking statement. And it really pushed, I think Now This did a video that had more than 5 million views. And it was, an excerpt of this speech. And you can read it in full in The Guardian. I'll be sharing these on my Twitter feed. And we can perhaps also share them with the episode. But it is terrifying because you have both the surveillance and then you have the ability of bad actors to stir things up in a way that perhaps was just not possible at the speed and scale. And I just read this 2018 profile of Mark Zuckerberg, and it was in the New Yorker. And there were two things in it that shocked me. One was that it quotes a Business Insider story that straight up a Trump campaign official said that they targeted liberals and like idealistic liberals, young women and I believe African Americans and immigrants for voter suppression in the last few days before the election. And that's when your casual voter gets excited. So this is in 2016. One of the things I've seen in doing advertising with candidates and with GOTV organizations is that there's just a huge surge in the few days before the election. And these are the folks who aren't tuned in. They're not following politics closely, and they're like Googling and searching for information. And so if you hit these folks with really negative advertising right before an election, and particularly negative advertising that's tailored for them, it can have a dramatic effect. In this profile of Zuckerberg, a reporter for the New Yorker was interviewing him while an active genocide was happening in Myanmar, with the Rohingya people being displaced and killed, and Facebook being one of the prime vehicles for the spread of ethnic and religious hatred. Zuckerberg didn't seem to be prepared for that. We also had 2017, Facebook was being shut down by the Indian government because of ethnic and religious violence, and over and over, dozens of times. So we can see that Facebook has a long and recent history of causing human rights violations, contributing to them. It's a place where if you put fake information or threatening information, or you say, you know, kill these people because they're doing X, Y, Z, you can inflame people's emotions and cause, you know, in the case of the Rohingya genocide. And Zuckerberg just does not really seem to have the kind of empathy that you would expect from someone running a platform that that has such an intimate role in people's lives. So the Sacha Baron Cohen speech, the thing that's really challenging to me is like, here we are, this episode's going to drop, it'll have been a week and a half, and the story's kind of gone again. So you can basically have Amnesty and Sacha Baron Cohen say, these are the worst threats to the world. And then people are like, okay, all right, we're going to get on. Okay, all right, let's go. You know, I hope that our elected leaders are listening and will take action, because, you know, if this platform, Facebook, has doubled 6 times in the last decade, you know, and it's going to continue to grow, Amnesty's report points at 4 billion people rely on the internet, it could get a lot worse. And so we've got to really take it seriously and regulate these companies, you know, take them seriously. They should be having hearings with Zuckerberg and other executives and experts, you know, daily on Capitol Hill. We can say that, you know, like, for example, that Donald Trump is a real threat, and we've got the impeachment hearings they're working on the report, it's my understanding, through the House. But we're not taking these giant corporate threats as seriously as they should be taken.
And doesn't it surprise you or kind of amaze you that Zuckerberg does have this sort of deer in the headlights look whenever he's asked any question of any sort of moral complexity? Because he had the same look when AOC asked him, you know, can I do this fake shit? Can I do this instance? What about this instance? And this sort of look that says that kind of implies that you never contemplated ever being asked that question. But I refuse to believe that. I can't possibly believe that.
I don't know. He told, I believe it was a question from Katie Porter in the same hearings where AOC was grilling him. She asked him if he would take an hour a day to be a content moderator. And he said, it's just not worth my time. It wouldn't be a good use of my time. And so he does seem to be very obtuse when it comes to issues of morality and human rights. And while you'd expect that he would have a better grasp on it, you know, the company continues to grow. Its profits continue to grow. Wall Street continues to be happy with it. And you can think that maybe he really doesn't care.
As someone who has worked with and tried to help several organizations, activist organizations, political education organizations, we often are flummoxed by the way certain things catch on Twitter and seemingly seem to do so by magic from the point of view of people that are just going into it. And so there really is so much utility in being able to use these horrible beasts for good purposes. And I feel like that's the core of a lot of work you've done, is that you've walked people through these very, very basic nodes and starting points.
Right. And it's funny because Amnesty actually was posting about their report on Facebook and kind of noting, you know, like, oh, but we still have to use it to get the word out, right? So the platforms are incredibly important, even when you're calling them a great human rights threat. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to share a little, I think one of the things I want to do with Adriel versus the oligarchs is always give you something practical. This show is sponsored by my consulting firm, and I want you to be able to walk away with something you can use that perhaps you didn't know. A lot of virality is really about luck. But one thing that's for certain is that if you are talking about the same thing everyone else is talking about, you're more likely to catch fire. Now, another way to hack virality that's pretty easy to do, pretty easy to replicate. It does take a lot of hard work, but it is something that I've had repeated success, and you can just kind of turn it on and off, is using replies. And a lot of people use replies like a comment thread, like you would see on a newspaper article. There's a lot of anonymous stuff. There's back and forth. And we'll talk on further episodes about like how to tailor your Twitter experience so that you're only getting the information you want to see. I've done a lot of work on that to just avoid getting trolled myself, getting pulled into arguments, and also getting your emotions triggered, because that's really how these platforms work. Like, they can make you feel angry or sad or embarrassed. They've got you, right? And a lot of people, that's their purpose. If you're trying to get out a message, you're trying to steer the conversation, influence the conversation, or you're trying to just get more visibility, what you can do, larger users who get a lot of comments can expose your comment to a lot of people. So like when AOC tweets or Bernie Sanders tweets or when Sean King tweets Jordan from, he's with Media Matters. These are users who might have 100, 1,000, 2,000 comments on most of their tweets. You don't want to, just because someone has 1 million followers doesn't mean they have an engaged audience. But if someone has 1,000 comments consistently, they're very engaged. Greta Thunberg is another one that is good in terms of a Twitter user that you can follow and comment on. So what am I talking about doing, like, practically? How do you implement this? Simply go to the profile of a user, you click on the bell plus symbol, and it turns on notifications for that user. Then you want to go into your own Twitter page, and you want to click the more button. Then you want to go to settings and privacy and notifications, and you want to turn on push notifications. And you can turn these on and off, but once you have them on, the users that you've set the notifications for, you'll get their tweets as like pop-ups on Chrome. And you can jump in and be one of the first people to comment. And so if you're one of the first people to comment when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is talking about the Green New Deal, Sean King is talking about police brutality, with a relevant comment, often with, I have like stores of photo after photo after photo and different memes that I can drop into these comment threads. Your comment, if it's one of the first and it's a decent comment, especially if it has image attached, it will often rack up 10, 20, 50,000 impressions just because you tagged on, you're drifting in the wake of this power user who gets tons of comments. So I've used this. When I do it, I can double, triple, quadruple the number of impressions I get in a day. Very proven and effective way to dramatically increase your reach on Twitter.
The one thing I would say is this is still a commitment. It's still going to take you.
It's real work.
Kind of being on top of things and setting those things up for yourself so that you're ready to hop in. Of course, you can have plug and play stuff, but you've got to have that made. You have to organize your shit in order to do this.
Yeah, I think it's really for people who are already using Twitter heavily, but maybe not as successfully. Not for like a casual user, because this is definitely a power user play. This is how you get millions of people to see your stuff every month.
Do you like fighting oligarchs?
Fighting oligarchs is my favorite thing.